Circle City President Lee Martin is going to introduce his discussion for today and the discussion of the Diversity and Inclusion Committee. Circle City Chapter President, Second Vice President of the National Federation of the Blind, here is Lee Martin.
Well, hello, everyone. Can you hear me there, President Brown?
Yes, sir. Coming through.
Okay. Well, thank you so very much. I want to tell everybody that we are looking forward to this presentation with our Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee of Indiana. They've been doing some great work with Dr. Yvette Reed as my co-chair, and she's here with the team, and they'll introduce themselves, and I'm sure that you will enjoy this upcoming hour with the panelists. So, Dr. Reed, it's all yours.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for having us. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, excellent, excellent. Welcome to our panel discussion today. We have some wonderful people here joining us to discuss their employment experiences. The title of this session is The Illusion of Inclusion, Working in the Shadows of Equal Employment Opportunity. And I want to take a moment and just introduce myself. Again, I'm Dr. Yvette Simmons-Reed. I am a tenure track assistant professor at Ball State University. I am in the Special Education Department and Applied Behavior Analysis graduate program. I do a lot of work in diversity, equity, inclusion. As Lee said, I am co-chair of the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee here in Indiana. Today we have with us six panelists, and I hope all is on. I know I saw a few on. And to set the stage a little bit for that, first I'm going to introduce the panelists, and then I'll set the stage for what our discussion is going to be about. We can have Colin Wong, if you would introduce yourself, tell your name, title, what you do, and one strategy that you use to advocate for yourself in employment.
Definitely. Thank you so much, Dr. Reed. And thank you to the Indiana affiliate for having me here today. My name is Colin Wong, and employment-wise, I am working at Savvy Services for the Blind, and I am a cane travel instructor as well as the training coordinator responsible for professional development. In today's position, I am representing the National Federation of the Blind Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee as the co-chair of that committee. And in terms of one thing I do for representing myself in employment, the one recommendation I tell people is making sure that you understand, one common thing that I hear a lot in the diversity field is, you know, why not just hide your particular intersectionality, you know, show that you could see a little bit more, or, you know, hide a little bit of your intersectionality so that you can fit in. And that's the number one thing that you cannot do, because even if you do not recognize your own personal identity, it is something that people recognize, and it is something that is a part of who you are. And it's an important piece of who you are. So when going into an employment opportunity, I always recommend, you know, if you do have a visual impairment, make sure you understand what people are going to be assuming. And it's unfortunate to say that, but once you're able to tackle those questions that people will be wondering about, such as your capabilities as a blind person and what accommodations you may or may not need, then you're able to answer those questions much more appropriately. And the worst thing that you can do when you're in an interview is be unprepared for a question. And people are going to have questions about what you can do. And if you're not able to answer that question before they make a negative assumption about what you can't do, then you're already ahead of the game. So always understand what people's expectations are going to be and shatter those expectations by understanding how to answer those questions ahead of time.
Thank you so much, Mr. Wong. Ms. Diane Graves, tell us your name, title, and a strategy you use to advocate for yourself in the workplace.
Sure. My name is Diane Graves. I've been employed with the Indiana Civil Rights Commission for just over 31 years now. And I have been serving the commission as a mediator since 2005. So I'm instrumental in helping both complainants and respondents to see the various strengths and weaknesses of their case and decide how best to resolve or settle the claims. And I think one of the most important things that I would say as an active employee is that if you have a need for a reasonable accommodation, you'll want to let your employer know that, because they can't, if they're making an oversight, not taking your needs into consideration, you need to let them know that, because they can't accommodate what they're not aware of. If they don't know your needs, they can't accommodate those.
Thank you so much. That's excellent advice. Next is Ms. Keelan Williams. Sorry.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Perfect. Hi, everybody. My name is Keelan Williams. I am an academic advisor at Ball State University. I have been in this position for 5 years now. And in my job, I work with over 400 undergraduate students, typically sophomores through when they graduate. Helping them with academic plans of study, like 4-year plans of study, getting them connected to resources across campus, being a cheerleader when they need a cheerleader, stuff like that. And one thing I've gotten better about doing is when there's a problem, in particular with, I use a lot of different software packages with my job. There's just a lot of technology involved. I am getting a lot better at not being afraid of saying, hey, has this been checked for accessibility issues? Or, hey, there is an accessibility issue. My screen reader won't read it. So I just try to advocate in that way.
Thank you so much. That's awesome. Next is Alex Gillen.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So, good morning. My name is Alex Gillen, and I am a general caseload vocational rehabilitation counselor here in Clarksville, or you could say Clark County. I have had this job for just over 5 months, believe it or not, and I got this job through the Gregory S. Feuerbach Center at Eskenazi Health, which I will be talking about in a different presentation later this afternoon, but I've had this job a little over 5 months, and I would say probably the biggest thing that I've done on the job is, because of my comfort level, I've kind of had issues in the past for standing up for myself and maybe being assertive, but I feel I have a wonderful group of people I work with, so I'm not afraid to say, oh, this software's not accessible. Maybe this VRLA module through the orientation courses that we're taking, maybe that needs a little work. And then in being a general caseload vocational rehabilitation counselor, I often let my participants know that, depending on what it is, if it's employment related and something comes up on the job, I always say, well, have you discussed this with your, we call it an employment consultant, or what I will say to them is, hey, have you discussed this matter with your job coach? Have you discussed this with HR? And in fact, someone a few weeks ago said, oh, no, I'll think about that. So I guess in short, what I do is try to, depending on what the situation is, just allow them to advocate for themselves and go about requesting accommodations in the best way appropriate for their situation.
So you really have a unique situation, because not only do you need the accommodations yourself, but also you're encouraging and trying to find employment for others. So
right.
That's awesome. Thank you so much. The next person is Tyler Shirk.
Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. My name is Tyler Sherrick. Good morning. And I have been employed with Walmart for the past 7 years. I'm a cart pusher. I'm legally blind. I got this job because I advocated for myself, and I wanted to be a positive difference for others. But the main reason why I got this job was because the manager at the time had somebody that was visually impaired and had a disability, so that worked in my favor. And so they gave me a 90-day testing period. And within 30 days, I got hired on part-time. I've been very successful, but the issues that I've experienced and still experience to this day is I kind of get taken advantage of. As far as scheduling, sometimes the scheduling, like to come to this convention, I had to ask 5 or 6 times for this stuff for the October dates off. And did you have a question?
Yeah, no. So Tyler, one of your strategies is that you are making requests. We're going to get into your story a little bit with the questions.
Okay.
That's one of your strategies that you use. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Is advocating. Excellent. Yes. Excellent. And we got one more participant, then we're going to get right back with you. Okay.
Okay.
On that. The next and final panelist, as you can see, we have a large panel today, is Carlos Taylor.
Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning on the panel. My name is Carlos Taylor. I'm the program manager for the Gregory S. Ferrybach Center at Eskenazi Health. Alex Gillen just mentioned our program. I've been with the center for about 2.5 years now. And essentially what we do is we work with college students in the state of Indiana with physical disabilities, visual, hearing, and mobility impairments. And we find internship opportunities for students to help improve employment outcomes for these students. We've had about 131 different students come through the program so far. It's been in existence for roughly 8 years. So that's in short what I do, helping college students find internship opportunities. What do I do as far as, advocating for myself? I'd have to say that, you know, in my job at Eskenazi Health and also in my prior role at Ball State University, I always found it important to have allies, to know who to go to, who to talk to about, you know, whatever the situation may be, accessibility, you know, is what we're talking about today. But to know who to go to, who can find the answers and help you find the person that has answers to whatever the situation may be. In both of my roles, both at Ball State and at Eskenazi Health, I will say I've been blessed to have some strong allies in my corner who can assist when I need to, especially for larger things. I mean, for smaller things, I can just advocate for myself. But sometimes, especially when it comes to large things, you just need others in your corner, so to speak. So that's been my strategy to help others realize what the situation is. You know, I'm fully capable of doing whatever this task is, as long as it's accessible, and finding ways to make that task accessible or other solutions to work through the situation. That's been my strategy.
And Carlos, that's excellent to jump off from, because that's exactly what the conversation is about today. Sometimes gets our presence in places, creates the illusion of equality, and folks are not aware of some of the other issues or inequities that are surround in employment sometimes. And so given that a majority culture values individualism and competitiveness versus collectivism, consistency and standardization versus equity and inclusion, quantity over quality, independence over interdependence, some of those values can create some microaggressions. And I often categorize these, I talk about these faces. So the faces of inequality or inequities that we deal with sometimes in the workplace create these interlocking situations of aggression that are often masked, operate in the abstract, and are disguised under the cloak or under cover of compliance. And they're very difficult to identify. I've categorized these into 5 categories that I call the faces of discrimination that we sometimes deal with. And I've had a conversation with our panelists about their experiences. One of those is the friendly facade. The friendly facade, those are practices and institutional policies that have a disparate impact on those who are blind or with differing abilities. that impacts their opportunity to access, maintain employment, and also advance in their employment. I'm not going to get into major examples because that's what my panelists will provide. The other category is the accommodation trap. These are practices that meet the compliance code under ADA, but require us to go above and beyond what others have to do in order to get our jobs done. Okay. And so if you ask for help, sometimes you're kind of trapped because, you have to, go beyond these, jump these hoops in order to get what you need. The other one is a culture of confusion. These are norms and practice behaviors that create crisis situations for people who are blind or visually impaired. And they also perpetuate the appearance of incompetence or disorganized, or, that make you appear that you are not capable of doing the job. The fourth one is environmental impediments that are aspects of the physical environment, infrastructure, schedules, what have you, that put us at a disadvantage. Sometimes it could be just buying a piece of equipment that we're not able to use and everybody's expected to use. Social sabotage. Those are attitudes, practices, biases that we deal with. Innuendo, actions that perpetuate perceptions that blind people are difficult, derelict, demanding, and devilish. Sometimes we're constantly having to ask over and over for certain things. So we're going to get into some of these conversations. This is, as our president stated, an opportunity to be enlightened if you are not aware of some of these things and gain a greater understanding of those things that we deal with that's not always captured. So given the fact that we have a very large panel, not everyone will get an opportunity to respond to questions. So I'll be calling on our panelists to speak, to address some of these issues and give examples of their experience. We are represented by a variety, not only higher ed, but also state employees, corporate, and what have you. So our first question to the panelists is, Title I of the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990 prohibits private employers, state and local government, employment agencies, and labor unions from discrimination against qualified individuals with disabilities in their job application process, hiring, compensation, advancement. In what ways do you think this law has met its aim, and in what ways do you think it has failed? And I'd like to hear from Mr. Wong first.
Thank you, Dr. Reed. The ADA has advanced the opportunity of blind people since its inception. It's provided a lot of opportunity for blind people and a lot of protections that blind people do not have. And the impact that the ADA cannot be negated or neglected. The issue that the ADA has in supporting blind people in today's age is the accountability factor. When you're talking about when somebody is at the interview, it is true that it is illegal to discriminate someone on the basis of their particular intersectionality, but the employer is also not required, the hiring manager is not required to disclose why somebody was not hired. So if somebody was discriminated because of their particular intersectionality, that does not actually have to be disclosed. So it's a lot of negative undertones within it, because as long as the person understands how to keep themselves safe from legal harm, and then they do not actually face any legal actions against any sort of discrimination. And discrimination is, especially when dealing with HR, is one of the hardest things to prove. Secondly, the ADA provides protections generally after something's already happened. Usually when you do not get accommodations and you're not getting proper accommodations, you can refer to the ADA to provide yourself a protection. And that is a good thing, But you also want to make sure that the employer is able to provide accommodations from the beginning so that you're not always working from behind. And that is one thing that AED is more difficult for them to protect against. And the third and last thing that I'll say is that the struggle with employment is when working through employment, a lot of times employers come from, it takes a lot for them to hire somebody and provide accommodations. It shouldn't be, but they are really worried about the legal consequences that they will face from the ADA, that oftentimes they do not provide them with the opportunity to actually prove themselves in the workplace. And accommodations are not a handout. It is not a help. It is a legal requirement. It is something that all blind people should have access to. However, what happens when employers, from my experience, provide accommodations, they see it as them having done such a great work that future opportunities seem to be limited because they already feel like they have done a lot for the particular blind individual. And that's not the case. Any accommodation should be from a place of equality, not from a place of sympathy. And I think that's what happens when employers are hiring blind people and prevents any upper mobility. But that's where I see the ADA has benefited. It put blind people on a much more equal level, not fully equal, but it can do a lot more with making sure that blind people are getting things in the beginning. So thank you so much, Dr. Reed.
Oh, thank you for such a thorough response. Diane?
Okay. My comments will mirror much of what Colin has said. I think the law has been somewhat successful in that it has raised the awareness of employers regarding the need and or mandate to include and consider employees for jobs and job candidates with disabilities. Some employers have certainly been more receptive to the concept than others. The law has mandated accessible construction of buildings and work sites constructed after the enactment of the law so that people with disabilities can have access to the workplace, whether they have a mobility impairment that requires the use of a wheelchair or other mobility device, or need Braille in elevators or other Braille signage. For example, most of the conference rooms in the Indiana Government Center South Conference facility have Braille room numbers. Mm-hmm. The law has given people with disabilities an avenue by which they can pursue justice if they experience discrimination. There was a time when we didn't have that. We didn't have that leg to stand on. Mm-hmm. So it has provided that avenue. However, the law can only go so far, as employers have gotten a bit more subtle about discrimination, particularly here in the state of Indiana. Indiana is an at-will state, which means that an employer can hire and fire for any reason. They don't have to tell you why. So while they can't necessarily say, we don't hire blind people here, if they can find someone who has just a minuscule amount of qualifications or attributes that the blind person doesn't possess or the disabled person doesn't possess, or if they can identify for an employee who's already on the job, if they can identify some performance areas in the workplace that might not be quite up to par, they can use those against you, masking the discrimination, which is very hard to prove. So this causes someone with a disability to have to work doubly hard, both to secure a job in the first place and then to keep that job or gain a promotion once they have it.
Thank you. That was excellent and very, very enlightening in terms of the Indiana being an at-will state. And also, you know, between both of your responses, the benefits of the law in terms of providing and making employers aware of the treasure trove of talent in our disability communities, that they are not only that, I know the research demonstrates loyalty that, you know, among those of us in the community in terms of working and maintaining our employment that we get. But again, you know, discovering the roadmap in terms of equal protection on, you know, when there is wrongdoing and we can prove it, there is an avenue for us to pursue. But as Colin and both of you have talked about, you know, this is very difficult to prove the fact that, one, employers don't have to tell you why they didn't hire you, and they find avenues and things like that. And that is the part that we talk about, that's that mask piece. And we're going to get into that in this next question. And this is finding employment is challenging for anyone. And it's particularly difficult for those in our blind community. In what challenges have you experienced in finding work? Describe the perceptions that or maintaining employment. Describe your perceptions in the interview process that you've discovered or in your performance evaluations. And this is for, I'm sorry, in your performance evaluations of your employers based on that kind of uncovers some of the issues that we've been talking about today. And that, Keelan, you want to speak to that?
Sure. Can you still hear me?
Yes.
I'll make sure I didn't accidentally mute myself. Landing this job at Ball State definitely was a journey. There were a lot of trials and failures before I got here. You know, applying to probably over 100 different places. And that's kind of normal for anybody, just the application process. But starting with the application, some places had some really good platforms for their applications that were like, okay, I can just copy and paste whatever I need to here. Others, not so much in terms of accessibility. Like, it was a lot harder to fill out the actual applications, just depending on the company and what the company used for their platform, if they even had a platform. I can definitely think of a handful of times where I would get a phone interview. Phone interview would go great. And then I would debate with myself, well, do I disclose now? Do I disclose if I get to the next step that I'm legally blind? Like, what? Just navigating that piece was very interesting. And again, it was a lot of trial and error. Okay, let this vibe sound, feels really good over the phone. I'm just going to tell them now. Or other times it was just like, well, let's just see what happens. When I would get to in-person interviews, that's where things would change. I have Stargardt's disease, so like I can see some, but not everything. And I do use a red and white cane, and I do wear very dark sunglasses. And there were a few times where I'd walk in and the cheeriness that Evie kind of mentioned earlier, that it kind of disappeared and it became kind of awkward as soon as I walked into the room. Sometimes the conversations would still go well until we had to get up and move around and they give me a tour. But I could just feel the vibe and feel the energy change once they saw me and once they saw my equipment. And I know I answered questions very, very well. And I would answer the question, like, even if they didn't ask, I would start talking about, well, you know, these are the kind of accommodations I use. This is the kind of equipment I use to get the job done. Like, I've gone through schooling and all that good stuff, but there definitely are times, where the interview process can be a little shaky. But in that sense, I think of it as, well, if you don't want me because of this one thing and I'm qualified to actually do the job, then I just think, you know what, then you don't deserve me. So I'll just move on until I find someone that deserves me. And that's how I landed in Ball State.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. I definitely, when you talk about the situation or the atmosphere, it's awkward. Do they Do you perceive that they think they've been tricked in some way? What is that?
Yes, I think there were at least a couple of times the vibe definitely felt like they were tricked, and they're kind of doing an eye roll and kind of doing like a shutting down kind of feel. Mm-hmm. Others just didn't know what to do. They were kind of shocked. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So even when I would, you know, walk them through and just explain it as matter of factly as I could, it was hard. It was hard to convince people. So, yeah.
So we gotta be in the, everybody has to sell themselves in the job interview, mm-hmm. you know, but we gotta sell ourselves beyond what the job mm-hmm. requires.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Alex, you want to take a shot at that one?
Okay. So as far as the interview process was concerned for me, I didn't really have a formal interview. I was fortunate enough to be in a situation going into my last internship. I think all of you know that there's such a need for VR counselors around the state, and they're happy to have, we have a, and Carlos will tell you, the Gregory S. Fehrbach Center has a really good relationship with VR. And so I had already done one internship, but really kind of needed another one to solidify things. I'll get into that more this afternoon. But basically, the second internship in Clarksville was basically my interview. Mm-hmm. And so they pretty much said, as long as we feel that you're doing the work you need to, and you like what you're doing here, and we like what you're doing here, and you feel it's a good fit, we're going to hold the position for you, and you'll be able to start. So I had to still go through really not too many hurdles as far as the process of starting the job was concerned. I was able to start on my targeted start date of May 3rd. Probably the toughest part was they make you take like a picture. I'm trying to remember what that picture was. And then it goes through the state, and you have to go to a certain designation to get it. And so one of the people I spoke to just to find out where these locations were on the phone, he was just rude. And I calmly just told him once, you know what, I appreciate your services, but I'm going to look elsewhere. And that was the conversation. So once I got started on the job, I pretty much picked up where I left off mm-hmm. as far as my work goes, because I pretty much knew a lot of the case management system and whatnot. But one of the issues I faced was that I had to use my personal laptop, and both the area supervisor, who also happens to have a disability, she is a wheelchair user, and myself, we knew that we were going to have to get on this as quick as we could as far as requesting accommodations. And so we tried to jump on that as quick as we could. And unfortunately, it took just over 3 months for me to get a state laptop. Well, not the state laptop, but it took 3 months to get JAWS on that laptop. And the day it actually happened was really interesting. So I'm somewhat to blame, because I think I was going to do it in the morning, meet up in the morning virtually with the person setting it up. But you know how VR is, you get into something and boom, you just go. So in the afternoon, when I talked to them about setting it up, they were like, oh, were you going to call this morning? And I said, oh, yeah, you know what? My apologies. I had something come up. But interestingly, as I was doing that, I was hearing kind of a side conversation going on about what drinks some of the folks wanted, or a game of beer pong. So that led me to wonder, hey, are we not getting our accommodations met sometimes because these guys are doing a few things on the job that I don't want to know about? So, it took about 3 months to get all that. And other VR counselors will tell you that it takes about that time or more to get your accommodations. And so when you're sitting up there with your participants saying, here's what you do to stand up for yourself, here's what we're going to do, you feel a bit like a hypocrite, because you, as a VR counselor, are not getting this met yourself. And so that's kind of the situation I found myself in. So my issue is not at all with VR. It's with the state's slow pace nature of this. It used to be, from what I'm told, that we could go through our VR counselors when we got started to request for what we needed. And had that been the case with me, I know that my VR counselor, who I believe is a great counselor, Jamie Walter, would have met that. And I think it would have been less than a month before I would have gotten everything at most. Because when I started my internships, it was recommended that I get a laptop that could be used for the case management system and could hold everything. And so when that happened, I got everything quick. But here, when I start the job, it takes 3 months.
That's beyond. But what you've mentioned, Alex, here is something I think a lot of us deal with. Tell me a little bit about when you were using your personal laptop, having to access some of the state database, you know, to do your job. What was that like? And was there, did that cause any problems? This speaks to us going above and beyond what others have to do who has a job.
Okay, so yes. As far as using the case management system, I had a lot of training during my internships. Mm-hmm. And whatnot. So I was good with that. But there were certain features of the case management system that you get with your state laptop that you're not going to be able to do on your personal laptop. And one of those things is that with the, for example, if you need to send an email through, you know, to your participant, you can do it right through the case management system, but you cannot do it on your personal laptop. So you know what I had to do? I had to have a good friend called copy and paste, and I would literally copy and paste an email into either Outlook or a Word document, and then put it into Outlook and put whatever it was I needed to say to the participant. So I couldn't use that aware case management to my advantage with doing emails. So I had to go above and beyond in that sense.
Yeah. And which also takes time.
It does. It takes at least, that's one of the things one of the my colleagues mentioned. She said, you know what, I bet when you get everything you need, you're going to cut your time by about a third at least. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think she's
and great. It matters in that job on how many clients you see.
Yes.
You know, and all that. And but when you're having to do all these workarounds, and sometimes you have so many workarounds, you get turned around because you get.
You're exactly right. It hasn't happened to me quite yet, but luckily I think I got everything just in time.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
No, okay. Thank you.
To our next question, in our next question, I'm going to ask the participants to describe any microaggressions, those biases, bias attitudes that you experience in the workplace and what as a result occurred. And I'm going to talk to, and this is any job or the job you're on. Tyler, you were getting into this earlier. What are some of the microaggressions that you experience in the workplace?
Basically, when I would need vacation days and whatnot to juggle personal life and stuff like that, I would put in for my days way in advance. Like I would be good at that. Like I'd put in 5 months in advance because I know how to plan very well, but they would take forever in approving them. And it would be like a month before, and I would have to go to my manager 5 or 6 times saying, hey, my stuff hasn't been approved yet. It's still pending. What's going on? And they're like, are you sure you put it in? Are you sure you did this? And I'm like, yeah. Like they would kind of talk to me like I was incompetent. And that would just, I wouldn't back down from that. I would be like, oh, okay, we're going to play that card. So I would just keep bugging him saying, well, you approved this person's days, but not mine. And it would be like, well, this person met this criteria, but we need you here. And they would just try to really confuse me. And so I'd have to be like, no, I put my vacation days way before this individual did. And therefore, we need to take a look at this. I would be careful not to sound entitled, because the bottom line, if they just didn't have coverage, I just couldn't get the days off. But it's gotten better, but I've still had to sit around and argue. And another thing is I would have computer-based learning on how to deal with different stereotypes, such as race and different religions and stuff like that. And it was very mind-blowing. I would hear about different races I've never heard of before, but I just used my character, how I was raised, how I was taught. And my mom taught me when I was 3 years old that just because somebody has a different skin color than you They're just like you. They're no different. And that's how I've treated people ever since. And I just say racism is a cuss word. I just try not to pick it up. And I've just been me. And I don't hide anything.
But if I might, Tyler, as it relates to you on the job, you talked about them making you feel like you've done something, like you're incompetent in some way. That's one of the microaggressions we're talking about. Are there other times that you've experienced microaggression against you? I know you talked about that one in terms of how others treat you as a person with a visual impairment.
Yeah.
Or any other comorbid disabilities. Is there other examples?
Yes.
The store is laid out, or you asking questions about that. Go ahead.
Not so much the store. I've got that memorized.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm on the autism spectrum, so I can memorize particularly numbers very easily.
Uh-huh.
And, they've recently started, online grocery pickup, and I wanted to apply for that position. And so I went in there and talked to them, and they're like, well, you could do it, but it involves you being fast, and we want to put you somewhere where you're comfortable. And I go, I want this position. It'll allow me to expand what I know. It'll help me expand my job performance. And they're like, well, you need to be fast. And they basically said, I'm too slow.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually said, do you think I'm slow? I asked my manager flat out, you think I'm slow at pushing carts? Well, you're not fast, but you're a medium.
So you've been denied opportunity because of your perceived slowness, but not being allowed to demonstrate your ability to do the online, which
exactly.
It's not moving through space with a cart.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Tyler. Carlos?
Yeah. So, as being blind, I think most people here probably experienced some form of a microaggression at some point in time or another. But, as far as for me, especially, at work, and I thought long and hard about this, and I don't have any examples to give you, especially pertaining to, my supervisor's direct supervision that I've had over the years, both at Ball State University, and in my role at Eskenazi Health. But just being who we are, being blind. And for me, the intersectionalities for me being African-American and blind, I think a lot of times for me is how do I react? How do I deal with any microaggressions that I may encounter? How do I either handle the situation? How do I grow from the experience? I mean, do I need to wear a different hat and educate somebody on a particular issue to help them understand and what have you? So it's knowing how to manage and not of course, depending on the situation, learning how to address it and move on and not let, because these things can really pile up on a person and take a toll on an individual, so I think it's a matter of learning how to handle them, learning how to deal with them, learning how to put them away when you're past that situation and not stew and dwell in that, because that can really.
So Carlos, I'm going to challenge you a little bit because.
Yes.
Yeah, because I like what you're saying. But when you say we got to learn how to do all these things, that in itself is problematic on a job. So yes. You've never been told how amazing you are
because
that can be perceived as a microaggression because it's putting you above on this pedestal and you have to live up to this expectation. Does that make sense?
Oh, it does. Absolutely.
You put that pressure on yourself, I'm sure, right?
I don't, when people tell me things like
and
that,
you've never done it.
Have I never put myself on a pedestal?
No. Put yourself, the expectation or the pressure on yourself to go beyond what others have to do.
Oh absolutely.
What creates that situation for you?
So going above and doing things that other people don't have to do, necessarily, I'll use, school for an example.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a current student right now. But there are just things that, you know, I have to do that other students don't have to, just due to, you know, some accessibility challenges. You know, if I have to meet with somebody to help interpret visual information, well, I know that, you know, other students in the class don't have to take this extra time out of their day to get this, you know, assistance. So these are things that I have to do above and beyond. And my time is very valuable. You know, I work full time as well, so I don't have, you know, unlimited time in a day. Okay. So, yeah, there's definitely things I do as a person that go above and beyond what other people have to do. And I guess part of that is part of me. And I realize in a perfect world that should not have to be the case. But I know I'm a hard worker. I'm willing to work hard to do what I need to do. And so that's just part of it for me. And now I know in a perfect world that shouldn't have to be the case. It shouldn't have to be. I know that. But I think there are circumstances where, you know, we have to make adaptations. We have to do things that other people, frankly, just don't have to go through.
Yeah, and do you feel like you've ever been denied advancement because of your visual impairment or because of your situation? Or you feel like, you know, others are getting promoted, you know, especially if, you know, I know you've been working in the disability community, you know, here at Ball State and at Eskenazi, but right. Do you feel like that others have been given opportunity that you have not?
I would say that
you can't prove it.
Right. I perceive sometimes that others do get opportunities. You know, I think that working in the field that I work in, it's assumed that you can only work in disability related fields. And mm-hmm. So, I mean, working in a disability related field, you're not going to get rich, you know, doing things, working in this field. But I think the perception oftentimes is this is the only type of work that a person with a disability can do. That is definitely not the case. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much. Appreciate that. I'm going to open it up. If any of my panelists have something that they want to add that we have not covered or speak on, we got about 2 minutes, and then I'm going to open it up for the audience. Something that's come up in the discussion, please raise your hand. And Michael, will you identify that person?
I can do that.
Oh, Ronald Brown Cellular.
Based on our discussion, anybody on the panel want to add something they thought of during this discussion? If not, Michael, we can go ahead and open it up to the audience for questions, and we can direct them to the different panelists.
Okay, but anyone would like to raise your hand? I'm seeing no raised hands.
Well, I want to thank everybody for joining us today, and I hope we've been able to enlighten you a little bit on some of those illusions that are created in our employment community that we continue to and need to continue to focus on. Thank you.